She knew Natalie wanted to go home because Dad kept telling her that Mom was going to be fine and she'd be coming out soon and they'd go home. But Simone wouldn't go, and they couldn't make her. Tish was dead, me was in surgery, and they couldn't make her. She kept the Coke can in both hands so her father wouldn't take her hand again. She didn't want anyone to hold her hand or cuddle her. Not yet. Maybe not ever. She just needed to wait on the hard plastic chair. The doctor came out first, and her father surged to his feet. Dad is so tall, Simone thought vaguely. So tall and handsome. He still wore his business suit and tie because he'd just come home from a business dinner, turned on the news. Then he'd rushed straight out to drive to the mall. The doctor gave her father some instructions. Minor concussion, some stitches. When her mother came out, Simone got shakily to her feet. Until that moment, she hadn't understood she'd been afraid her mother really wasn't okay. Her mother would be like me, or worse, like Tish. But her mother came into the waiting room. She had those weird bandages in a couple places on her face, but she didn't look pale, pale, pale the way she had. The way Simone imagined dead people looked. Natalie leaped up, flung her arms around their mother.
"There's my brave girl," Tulip murmured. "My brave girls," she said, reaching out for Simone.
And finally Simone wanted to be touched, wanted to hold and to be held. She wrapped her arms around her mother with Natalie between.
"I'm okay. A bump on the head. Let's take our girls home, Ward."
Simone heard the tears in her mother's voice, clung tighter for one more moment, and closed her eyes when her father wrapped his arms around the three of them.
"I'll go get the car."
Simone pulled back.
"I'm not going. I'm not going home now, sweetheart."
But Simone shook her head fiercely, moved another step away from her mother's tired face with its nicks and bandages.
"I'm not going. Me. They're operating on me. I'm not going."
"Sweetheart," Tulip tried again.
"There's nothing you can do here, and I can be here."
"Nat, do you remember where we parked the car?"
"Yeah, Dad, but..."
"Take your mom out."
He passed Natalie the key.
"You two go out to the car and give me and Simone a minute."
"Ward, the girls need to be home. They need to be away from here."
"Go on out to the car," he repeated,
even as Simone sat again, her arms folded in a picture of defiant misery. He pressed his lips to his wife's cheek, murmured something, then sat beside Simone.
"I know you're scared. We all are."
"You weren't there."
"I know that, too."
She heard the misery in his voice now, but shook it off, pushed it away.
"Simone, I'm sick and sorry about Tish. I'm sick and sorry about me. I promise you we'll check on me from home and I'll bring you to see her tomorrow, but your mother needs to go home. So does Natalie."
"Take them home."
"I can't leave you here."
"I have to stay. I left them. I left them."
He pulled her to him. She resisted, tried to yank free, but he was stronger and held her until she broke.
"I'm sick and sorry about Tish and me," he repeated, "and I'll be grateful for the rest of my life you weren't in the theater. I need to take care of your mom and your sister now. I need to take care of you."
"I can't leave me. I can't. I can't. Please don't try to make me."
He might have, and Simone worried he would have, but as she pulled back from him, Cece rushed in. Long, flying red hair, a half dozen strings of beads and crystals around her neck, a swirling blue skirt and Doc Martens sandals. She scooped Simone up and folded her in yoga-fit arms and a cloud of peachy perfume with just the faintest hint of marijuana.
Thank God, oh baby. Oh, thank every god and goddess. Tulip?
She demanded of Ward.
Natalie?
They just went out to the car. Tulip got a couple of bumps and scrapes, that's all. Nat's fine.
Cece will stay with me.
Simone turned her lips to her grandmother's ear.
Please, please.
Sure I will. Are you hurt? Are you...
He killed Tish. Me. They're operating.
Oh, no.
Cece rocked her, swayed her, wept with her.
Those sweet girls. Those sweet young girls.
Dad has to take Mom and Natalie home. I have to wait here. I have to wait for me. Please.
Of course you do. I've got her, Ward. I'll stay with her. I'll bring her home when Mee's out of surgery. I've got her.
Simone heard the snap of steel in Cece's words and knew her father had been about to object.
All right. Simone?
He cupped her face, kissed her forehead.
You call if you need me. We'll pray for me.
She watched him go, slipped her hand into Cece's.
I don't know where she is. Can you find out?
Cece Lennon had a way of getting people to tell her what she wanted to know, of doing what she thought they should do. It didn't take long for her to lead Simone up to another waiting room. This one had chairs with pads, sofas and benches, even vending machines. She saw Mee's parents, her older sister, her younger brother, her grandparents. Mee's father saw her first. He looked 1,000 years older than he had when they'd picked Mee up for the movies. He'd been working in his front garden, she remembered, and had waved them off. He rose, walked over with tears swirling in his eyes to hug her.
I'm so glad you weren't hurt.
His English was perfect and precise, and he smelled of freshly cut grass.
I left them. I had to use the bathroom, and I left them. Then...
Ah, I'm glad for it. Ms. Lennon, it's kind of you to come.
Cece,
she corrected.
We're all family now.
We'd like to wait with you.
Send all our healing thoughts and lights to me.
His chin wobbled as he fought to compose himself.
Simone, my treasure, why don't you go sit with Mee's mom?
She put an arm around Mr. Jung's shoulders.
Let's take a little walk.
Simone went over to sit by Mrs. Jung. And when Mrs. Jung gripped her hand, Simone held tight. She knew Cece believed in vibes and light and burning sage and meditation, and all sorts of things that made her daughter roll her eyes. Simone also knew that if anyone could make me be okay through sheer force of will, it was Cece. So she clung to that, just like she clung to Mee's mother's hand. Chapter 3 When Cece came back, Simone got up so Mr. Jung could sit next to his wife. Before she took another seat, Mee's sister, Nari, took her arm.
Help me get tea.
Simone went with her across the big room to a counter with pots of hot water, coffee, tea bags, and disposable cups. Nari, slim, studious, in her second year at MIT, efficiently set up a cardboard tray.
They won't tell you.
She spoke quietly, giving Simone a long look, dark eyes through the lenses of dark-framed glasses.
It's bad. Mee was shot 3 times.
Simone opened her mouth, but no words came out. There were no words.
I heard one of the police talking to a nurse after they took her to surgery. She lost so much blood. She's so tiny, and she lost a lot of blood. Will you go with me to give blood for her? It might not go to her, but...
Yes. What do we do? Where do we go?
Because she was a minor, Simone needed Cece. They took turns because so many people were doing just as they were. Simone looked away before the needle went in because needles made her feel a little sick. She drank the little cup of orange juice after as instructed. On the way back, she told Cece she needed to use the bathroom.
I'll go with you.
No, that's okay. I'll be right there.
She wanted to go alone, mostly because she needed to throw up the orange juice. But when she went inside, she saw a woman standing at one of the sinks, crying. Tiffany's mother. Mrs. Bryce had been her seventh grade language arts teacher. That same year, and everyone knew, Mr. Bryce had divorced her to marry the woman, lots younger, he'd had an affair with because the woman was pregnant. Simone realized she hadn't thought of Tiffany or Trent, the boy she'd thought she loved.
Mrs. Bryce.
Still sobbing, the woman turned.
I'm sorry. I'm Simone Knox. You taught me in middle school. I know Tiffany. I saw her tonight before. Before.
You were there?
With Mi Hee Jung and Tish Olsen. In the movies. They're operating on me. She got shot. She got shot. He killed Tish.
Oh, God.
They stood, tears streaming.
Tish. Tish Olsen, oh, God. Oh, God.
When she threw her arms around Simone, Simone clung to her.
Tiffany's in surgery. She... They can't tell me.
Trent? She was with Trent.
Mrs. Bryce stepped back, pressed the heels of her hands to her eyes, shook her head.
I'll pray for me.
She turned back to the sink, ran water, splashed and splashed it on her face.
You'll pray for Tiffany.
I will,
she promised, and meant it. She didn't need to throw up anymore. She already felt empty. In the waiting room, she fell asleep with her head in Cece's lap. When she woke, she stayed curled there, her mind so foggy it seemed a thin layer of smoke blurred the room. Through it, she saw a man with gray hair and blue scrubs talking to Mrs. Bryce. And Mr. Bryce, she realized, and the woman he'd gotten pregnant and married. Mrs. Bryce was crying again, but not the way she had in the bathroom. She had her hands clutched together in her lap, her lips pressed tight, but she kept nodding. And even through the layer of haze, Simone saw gratitude. Tiffany hadn't died. Not like Tish. Not like Trent. Me wouldn't die either. She couldn't. They waited. She drifted off again, but lightly now, so she felt Cece shift. This doctor was a woman with ink-black hair pulled back from her face. She had an accent, Indian maybe. Simone heard it, but it faded off as the words registered through the fog as she pushed herself up. Me had come through surgery. Bullet wound in the right arm. No muscle damage. Bullet nicked the right kidney. Repaired. No permanent damage likely. Chest wound. Lungs full of blood. Draining, repairing, transfusions. The next 24 hours critical. Me, young and strong. Once she's out of recovery and in ICU, you can see her. Briefly. Only two at a time. She's sedated, the doctor continued. She should sleep for several hours. You should try to get some rest. Mrs. Jung cried, but like Mrs. Bryce had.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll wait and go see her.
Mr. Jung put an arm around his wife.
I'll have you taken up to ICU, but only family. She added, with a glance at Simone and Cece.
This girl is family, Mr. Jung said.
Relenting, the doctor looked back at Simone.
I'll need your name for the approved visitors list.
Simone Knox.
Simone Knox? The first 911 caller?
I don't know. I called them.
Simone, you should know. By calling them so quickly, you gave me a fighting chance. I'll put your name on the list.
After Simone had gone home to her bed, to dark, fractured dreams. Michael Foster sat by his wife's hospital bed while she slept. She'd wake, ask about Brady again. Her short-term memory was disrupted but would come back, they told him. For now, he needed to reassure her any time she surfaced that their son hadn't been harmed. Reed Quartermain. They owed Reed Quartermain for that. She'd wake, he thought. She'd live. And, due to a bullet in the spine, she'd never walk again. One bullet struck her just below the shoulder blade, but the other hit her lower spinal cord. He tried to believe they'd been lucky, because he'd have to believe it to convince her. If the bullet had hit higher, she could have lost feeling in her trunk, in her arms. She might have needed a breathing tube, might not have been able to turn her neck. But they'd been lucky. She'd been spared the trauma of losing control of her bladder and bowels. With time and therapy, she'd be able to operate a motorized wheelchair, even drive. But his beautiful wife, his wife, who loved to dance, wouldn't walk again. She'd never run on the beach again with Brady, go hiking, jog up and down the stairs in the house they'd scrimped and saved for. All because three sick, selfish bastards had gone on some senseless murder spree. He didn't even know which one of the three had hurt his wife, the mother of his child, the love of his goddamn life. It didn't matter which, he thought. They'd all done it. John Jefferson Hobart, a.k.a. J.J., age 17. Kent Francis Whitehall, age 16. Devon Lawrence Paulson, age 16. Teenagers. Sociopaths, psychopaths, he didn't care what label the shrinks slapped on them. He knew the death count, at least as of 4 a.m. when he'd last checked. 89. And his Lisa was one of the 242 injured. Because three twisted boys, armed to the fucking teeth, had walked into the mall on a Friday night with a mission to kill and maim. Mission accomplished. He didn't count them among the dead. They didn't deserve to be counted. But he could be grateful to the cop who'd taken out Hobart, and grateful the other two had killed themselves, or each other. That detail remained unclear as of 4 a.m. He could be grateful there would be no trial. Grateful he, a man who dedicated himself to saving lives, wouldn't spend sleepless nights imagining killing them himself. Lisa stirred, so he shifted closer. When her eyes opened, he brought her hand to his lips.
Brady?
He's fine, baby. He's with your mom and dad. He's fine.
I had his hand. I started to grab him up and run, but then...
He's fine, Lisa, honey. He's fine.
So tired.
When she drifted off, he went back to watching her sleep. Reed woke at dawn with his head banging, his eyes burning, his throat desert dry. The world's worst hangover without a single drop of alcohol. He showered, his third since coming home to his exhausted, grateful parents and his clinging, weeping sister. He just couldn't get over the way Angie's blood had soaked through his pants and onto his skin. He knocked back some Advil, guzzled water straight from the faucet. Then he booted up his computer. He didn't have any problem finding stories on the shooting. He studied the three names listed, then the photographs. He thought maybe he recognized Whitehall, but couldn't figure from where. He knew he recognized Paulson. He'd seen him riddle a man's body with bullets and laugh. One of the two had killed Angie, as the report said the third, Hobart, never got out of the theater. One of them had killed Justin, a busboy at Manja, his first summer job. And Lucy, a waitress who'd planned to retire at the end of the year and hop into their RV to tour the country with her husband. Customers, too. He didn't know how many. Dory was in the hospital. So were Bobby and Jack and Mary. Rosie told him the boy with the guns had walked through the glass doors, sprayed the main dining room with bullets, then walked out again. 10 seconds? 20? No more. He read eyewitness reports, stopped and read the one on GameStop twice. We heard the shooting, but didn't really know what it was. The shop's noisy. Then somebody came running in yelling somebody was shooting people. He was bleeding, but didn't even seem to know he'd been shot. That's when the store manager, I don't know his name, started telling everybody to get into this back room. Some people started to run out, but the shooting got closer. You could hear it, and the manager kept telling people to get in the back. It was really tight in there. The store was crowded. I was never so scared in my life as being crammed in that room. People were crying and praying, and he said we had to be quiet. Then we heard it, the shooting, really loud, right out in the store, glass breaking. I thought we were all going to die, but then it stopped. Or I guess it moved away. He wanted us to stay in there until the police came, but somebody panicked, I guess, and pushed out of the door. Some people ran out. Then police came and took us outside. That boy saved our lives, the young manager with the thick glasses. I'm convinced he saved our lives.
Way to go, Chaz, Reed murmured.
In the little kitchen of her little apartment, Essie brewed a full pot of coffee. She'd have plenty of time to drink it as she'd been taken off the roll. Her CO assured her she'd be back on, and likely get a medal, but the process had to play out. She'd not only fired her weapon, she'd killed. She believed her CO and knew she'd done her job, but figured she'd stay half on edge until being cleared for duty. She hadn't realized just how much she needed to be a cop until there'd been the tiniest doubt that she could be dismissed. While the old cat slept on a cushion, Essie made herself a bagel and took her last banana. Since the size and layout of the apartment allowed her to see the screen from her kitchen-slash-dining-slash-work table, she sat there and switched on the TV. She knew the press had her name, and an earlier glimpse out the window proved they'd tracked her down. She wouldn't go out of the apartment and into the volley of questions and cameras. Someone had leaked her landline number, so she'd unplugged it. The constant ringing bugged the shit out of her. So far, her cell phone remained secure. If her partner or her CO wanted to reach her, they would. Plus, she still had email. She opened her laptop as she ate and watched the early news shows for any information she didn't already have. Using the laptop, she made a list of names she had in her head. Simone Knox, her mother, her sister, Reed Quartermain, Chaz Bergman, Michael, Lisa, and Brady Foster, Mi Hee Jung. She'd follow up with all of them, even if it had to be on her own time. She noted down the names of the shooters. She intended to dig out everything she could on them, on their families, their teachers, their friends, employers, if any. She wanted to know them. She typed out the numbers, current, of dead, of wounded, added names when she had them. She'd get the rest. She'd been doing her job, she thought as she watched, as she ate, as she worked. But that didn't mean it wasn't personal. Cece Lennon lived life by her own rules. Two of the top rules, try not to hurt anybody and have the balls to say what you think, often clashed. But the result blended with her be an asshole when necessary rule, so it worked for her. She'd been raised by sober, Methodist, traditional Republican parents in Rock Point, an upper-class suburban haven of Portland, Maine. Her father, a financial executive, and her mother, a housewife, self-proclaimed and proudly, had belonged to the country club, attended church every Sunday, and hosted dinner parties. Her father had bought a new Cadillac every 3 years, played golf on Saturday mornings and tennis, doubles with his wife, on Sunday afternoons, and collected stamps. Her mother had had her hair done on Mondays, played bridge on Wednesdays, and belonged to the garden club. Deborah, never Deb or Debbie, Lennon, had kept her pin money inside a white glove in her top dresser drawer, had never in her life written a check or otherwise paid a bill, and greeted her husband with freshened makeup after his day of work. She had mixed his evening drink, a dry gin martini, one olive, except during the summer season when he switched to gin and tonic with a twist of lime, so he could unwind until dinner. The Lennons had employed a daily housekeeper, a weekly groundskeeper, and, in the season, a pool boy. They had owned a vacation home in Kennebunkport and were considered by themselves and others pillars of the community. Naturally, Cece rebelled against everything they were and stood for. What was a child of the 60s to do but appall her conservative parents with her passionate embrace of the counterculture? She denounced the patriarchal structure of the church and their lifestyle, railed against the government, actively protested the war in Vietnam, and literally burned her bra. At 17, Cece packed a bag and hitchhiked to Washington to march. From there, along with sex, drugs, and rock and roll, she traveled. She spent springtime in New Orleans, sharing a ramshackle house with a group of artists and musicians. She painted for tourists. She'd been born with the talent. She rode to Woodstock in a van she helped paint into psychedelic wonder. Sometime during the rain-soaked bliss of that weekend in August, she conceived a child. When she realized she was pregnant, she cut out the drugs and alcohol, adjusted her vegetarian diet, as she would do countless times for countless reasons over the decades, and joined a commune in California. She painted, learned to weave, planted and harvested vegetables, tried and failed at a lesbian relationship, but she tried. She gave birth to her daughter on a cot in a dilapidated farmhouse on a pretty spring afternoon as Janis Joplin rocked it out on the record player and Tulip swayed in the breeze outside the open window. When Tulip Joplin Lennon was 6 months old, Cece, missing the green of the East Coast, caught a ride with a group of musicians. Along the way, she hooked up briefly with another musician-songwriter who, stoned, offered her $3,000 to paint him. She did, with him wearing only his Fender Stratocaster and a pair of shit-kicker boots. Cece moved on. The subject of her painting got a record deal and used her painting for the album cover. As luck would have it, he had a major top 40 hit with the single Farewell Cece, and the album went gold. 2 years later, while Cece and Tulip lived in a group house in Nantucket, the songwriter OD'd. The painting went on the auction block, sold for $3 million. And Cece's career as an artist truly launched. 7 years after she'd hitchhiked to D.C., Cece's father contracted pancreatic cancer. Though she'd sent postcards and mailed photos of their granddaughter, called them two or three times a year, communications had remained scattered and tense. But her mother breaking down over the phone had Cece following another of her rules. Help when you can. She packed up her daughter, her art supplies, and her bike in a third-hand beater of a station wagon and went home. She learned a few things. She learned her parents loved each other deeply. And that deep love didn't mean her mother could handle the dirty work. She learned the house where she grew up would never be her home again, but she could live there as long as she served a purpose. She learned her father wanted to die at home, and because she loved him, surprise, she would damn well make sure he got his wish. While she drew the line at her mother's strong suggestion of private school, she enrolled Tulip in the local public elementary. While she drove her father to chemo, to his doctor's appointments, cleaned up puke, her mother happily tended to Tulip. Cece hired a male nurse whose compassion, Kindness and love of Rock made them lifelong friends. For 21 months, she helped nurse her dying father and ran the household accounts, while her mother clung to denial and spoiled Tulip. Her father died at home, with the wife who loved him curled beside him in their bed, and his daughter holding his hand. Over the next few months, she accepted that her mother would never become independent, would never learn how to balance a checkbook or fix her own leaky faucet, and accepted she would go raving mad if she stayed in suburbia in a not-so-mini mansion with a woman who could barely figure out how to change a light bulb. As her father had left her mother more than financially secure, Cece hired a business manager, an on-call handyman, and an eager young housekeeper, as the other had retired, who would also stand as a companion. When she learned, during those 21 months, her father had changed his will and left her $1 million, after taxes, her first reaction was rage. She didn't need or want his conservative right-wing establishment money. She could, and was, supporting herself and her daughter through her art. The rage faded when she took Tulip for a ferry ride to Tranquility Island and saw the house. She loved the ramble of it, the wide terraces on the first and second levels, the views of the water, its narrow little strip of beach, that curve of rocky coastline. She could paint forever. The for sale sign was just that to Cece, a sign. Only a 40-minute ferry ride from Portland, far enough, thank God, from her mother, but close enough to assuage any guilt. A village with a cheerful artists' community and easy bike ride away. She bought it, after a hard-eyed negotiation, for cash, and began the next chapter of her life. Now she was back in upper-class suburbia, briefly, she hoped, in the home of a daughter who'd always been more like her grandmother than the mother who'd tried to give her a sense of adventure, independence, and freedom. Because help when you can was still a rule. And she loved her grandchildren beyond measure. She made breakfast for her daughter and ward in their sleekly modern kitchen. She'd unplugged the phones, closed the curtains and drapes as reporters gathered outside. She'd listened to the news on the guest room TV and heard the replay of Simone's 911 call. It had chilled her to the bone. Someone had leaked not only the call, but Simone's name. She sat with Ward and Tulip in the breakfast nook of the kitchen, made her pitch. "Let me take Simone to the island, at least until school starts."
"She needs to be home," Tulip began.
"The press isn't going to leave her alone. She was the first call for help. She's a beautiful 16-year-old girl. One of her friends died and the other is in the hospital."
"Me made it through the night," Cece added. "She's still critical, but she made it."
Ward let out a shaky breath.
"They wouldn't give me any information on her when I called."
Cece looked at him. He was a good man, she thought. A good man, good husband, good father. At the moment, he looked exhausted.
"Juan had them put my name and Simone's on the family list."
Because he was a good man, Cece reached out, laid her hand over his.
"You should call him."
"I will. Yes, I'll call him."
Now Cece laid a hand over her daughter's.
"Tulip, I know you need your girls and they need you right now. I'll stay as long as I can help. Simone won't leave until she's sure you're all right and me's all right. And I imagine the police are going to need to talk to her."
"We'll have to make a statement to the press,"
Ward added.
"You're right. They won't leave her alone."
"You're right, too. But after all that, let me take her. Give her a few weeks of peace and quiet. Even with the crazy of summer people on the island, I can give her that, and me when she's well enough. No one will bother her or them, I'll see to that. And Simone's going to need someone to talk to about everything, besides us. I have a friend. He spends part of the summer on the island.
He's a therapist with offices in Portland. You can check out his credentials, Ward. You can meet him. Talk to him.
I'd have to do all of that.
I know, but you'll learn he's very good. She'll need to talk to someone.
So will you and Natalie, baby.
I don't want to talk to anyone, see anyone right now. I just want to be home with my family.
Cece started to speak, but Ward shook his head in warning.
Okay. Think about this instead. After you've had that, a few weeks on the island might help Simone get away from all of it. Natalie, too, if she wants to come. But I know she's had her heart set on that equestrian camp, and that's coming up in a couple weeks. She likes spending time on the island, but Simone loves it.
We'll talk about it,
Ward said.
We're grateful, Cece, for
none of that. Family does what family needs. And right now, I think this family needs more coffee.
As she stood, Simone came in. Dark circles under her dazed, heavy eyes stood out stark against her pallor.
Me woke up. The nurse said the doctor was in with her, and her dad said... He said she asked for me. I have to go see me.
Sure you do, but you need to have some breakfast. You don't want me to see you looking so pale. That won't help her feel better, will it, Tulip?
Come sit down, sweetie,
her mother urged.
I'm not hungry.
Just a little bit. Cece's going to fix you just a little bit.
She sat, looked at her mother's face. The bandages, the bruises.
Are you feeling better?
Yes.
But her eyes welled.
Don't cry, Mom. Please. I didn't know where you were. I hit my head and poor Nat. It was only for a minute,
she said.
But I was confused and scared. I could hear the shooting, the screaming, and I didn't know if you were all right, if you were safe. I know me needs to see you, but I need you for just a little while first.
I didn't know if you and Nat...
I didn't know.
She sat next to her mother, pressed her face to Tulip's shoulder.
When I woke up, I thought it was a bad dream. But it wasn't.
We're okay now.
Tish isn't.
Tulip stroked, rocked.
I'm going to call her aunt. I'd call her mother, but I think I'll call her aunt. I'll ask if there's anything we can do.
Trent's dead, too.
Oh, Simone. I saw on the news. I looked before I came down and I saw the names, the pictures of who did this. They went to my school. I know them. I went to school with them. I had classes with one of them. And they killed Tish and Trent.
Don't think about it right now.
Denial, Cece thought. Like her grandmother. Close your eyes to the bad shit until you couldn't. Cece watched Simone get up and go sit on the other bench to face her parents.
They said my name in the news report. I looked outside and there are people. Reporters.
You don't need to worry about that. Ward told her. I'll take care of it.
It's my name, Dad. And my voice. They played my call to the police. They had my yearbook picture. I don't want to talk to them. Not now. I need to see me.
Your dad'll talk to them, Cece said briskly as she brought over a single scrambled egg, two strips of bacon, a piece of toast with butter. And your mom's going to help you with some makeup. My tool always had a hand with makeup. We're going to put your hair up under a ball cap. You're going to put your wayfarers on, and you and I are going out the back while your dad has them busy out front. We're going to cut across the backyards to where I parked the car in the Jeffersons' driveway. I called them last night to clear that. Then all we have to do is call the hospital and have them get us in a side entrance.
That's a damn good plan.
Ward murmured.
When you have to make some quick exits from hotels, motels, wherever, you learn the ropes.
We'll get you to me. Cece smoothed a hand over the tangle of Simone's hair.
Just eat a little first.
Chapter 4 It worked, exactly the way Cece said it would.
though it seemed to Simone like some weird dream, like the ones she'd have when she wasn't exactly awake or exactly asleep. Everything felt vivid and blurred at the same time, with sounds coming down some echoing tunnel. But when Cece guided her into ICU, Simone's heart started beating so loud and fast inside what felt like squeezing hands. The sensation shot her straight back to the bathroom stall where she'd crouched with her dead phone and terror.
Cece?
Breathe. In through your nose, like your belly's a balloon you're inflating, then out through your nose like it's deflating. In and out, she crooned, an arm around Simone's waist. That's right. You're all right. Me's going to be all right, so you'll breathe for her. Look, there's Nari. Nari, face pale with fatigue, eyes bruised from it, rose and walked to them.
Our parents are in with me. The doctor said they'll put her in a step-down room soon, maybe today, because her condition's improved.
She's better?
Simone's throat filled.
She's really better?
She's better, I promise. She looks...
Nari pressed her lips together when they trembled.
She looks very frail, but she's better. We had to tell her about Tish. She needs to see you, Simone, very much.
Nari, sweetie, have you been here all night? Cece asked her.
My grandparents took my brother home. I stayed with my parents. We just couldn't leave her.
I'm going to get you some coffee. Or tea? A soda?
I'd be grateful for coffee.
Simone, sit with Nari. And Nari, when your mom and dad come out, the three of you should go home and get some sleep. Simone and I'll stay. We're going to start taking shifts, so someone's always here. Go on and sit.
I don't know if they'll leave,
Nari said after Cece had gone to find coffee.
Cece will convince them. She's good at that.
To be brave for me meant starting now, Simone thought, leading Nari back to the chairs.
We'll take turns so me isn't ever alone. She remembers. Some, anyway, she remembers. The police talked to her this morning. The doctor only let them talk to her for a few minutes. Have you talked to the police? Not today. Not yet today.
Cece came back with a Coke for Simone, coffee for Nari.
A lot of cream, a little sugar, right?
Yes.
Nari managed a smile.
You remembered.
Got it locked in.
Cece tapped a finger on her temple, sat.
I was a roadie on and off for a few years. You learn to lock in how people like their coffee, their liquor, their sex.
Cece.
Facts of life, my girls. Are you seeing anyone, Nari?
Simone didn't know how her grandmother did it, but even then could see why she did. She took Nari out of the terrifying moment and into the normal. In 3 minutes, she learned more than Simone suspected me or their parents knew of the boy Nari had started dating. An Irish Catholic boy from Boston who was, even now, driving up to be with her. When Mee's parents came out, Cece rose, went over to quickly embrace each of them. During their murmured conversation, Simone saw Mrs. Jung look back toward the doors with tears in her eyes, but Cece kept talking in that low, soothing way. Like a dream, Simone thought again, when, within minutes, the Jungs agreed to go home for a little while. When it was done, Cece sat again, patted Simone's knee.
They don't think they'll sleep, but they will. The body and the spirit need recharging, and the spirit will guide the body.
I didn't know Nari had a real boyfriend.
I don't think she did either until he said he was dropping everything and coming to be with her. Now, I want you to think strong, positive thoughts.
With a finger tapping in the air, Cece gave Simone a knowing look, out of eyes Simone thought of as golden, and were, in fact, the same shade as her own.
And don't think I can't see the smirk you're giving me inside your head. Think them anyway. You're going to cry together, but that's a healing thing, whether it feels like it now or not.
You're going to listen to her, to whatever she needs to say. And you're going to tell her the truth about whatever she asks you, because if you break trust with each other now, you may not get it back.
I don't want to say anything that makes it worse.
It's already worse, and you're going through it together. You need truth between you. There's her nurse now. Go see your sister, baby. Strong and brave. She didn't feel strong and brave, not with the buzzing in her head and that squeezing inside her chest. She nodded at the nurse, but didn't really comprehend what she said. It all got worse when she saw me through the glass. Me looked so small, so sick. Frail, Nari had said, but to Simone's eyes, me looked broken. Something fragile already dropped and shattered. Me's exhausted eyes met hers, and tears spilled. She didn't remember going in. Couldn't remember if the nurse had told her not to touch me. But she had to. Had to. She pressed her cheek to me's, gripped hands that felt as thin as bird's wings.
I thought I was afraid they lied.
Me's voice, thin as her hands, choked with sobs.
I was afraid you were dead too, and they weren't telling me. I was afraid.
I'm not. I'm here. I didn't get hurt. I wasn't there. I left.
Simone heard herself, and heard Cece. Listen to her.
Is Tish really dead?
Her cheeks still pressed to Mee's, Simone nodded. They cried together, with Mee's frail body shaking under hers. Simone shifted so she could sit on the side of the bed, hold Mee's hand.
He came in. I didn't see him at first. Then we heard the shooting and the screaming, but it happened so fast and we didn't know what was happening. Tish said, "What's happening?" And then...
Me closed her eyes.
Can I have some water?
Simone got the cup with the bendy straw, held it for me.
He shot her. Simone, he shot her. And I felt this, like this awful pain, and Tish fell on me, just sort of tipped over on me. And I felt more pain, and she was, I don't know, jerking. Simone, he kept shooting her, and she was kind of over me, so she died. I didn't. She saved me. I told the police. I couldn't move. I couldn't help her. And I was awake, but it didn't seem real. He just kept shooting and shooting. Then it all stopped. The shooting. But people were screaming and crying. I couldn't scream and I couldn't move. I thought I was dead and then I just went away, I guess. I don't remember until I woke up here.
Her fingers squeezed, light as wings, on Simone's.
Am I going to die?
Tell her the truth.
You were really hurt, and we were so scared. It took hours before the doctor came out, but she said you did really well. And today they said they're going to take you out of ICU because you're not critical anymore. Cece's here with me, and she talked your parents into going home for a little while to sleep. They'd never go home if you were going to die.
Me closed her eyes again.
Tish did. Why?
I don't know. I can't. I still think it's not real.
You went to the bathroom. What happened?
I was coming back, and I thought the noise was from the movie. But someone, a man, tried to run out and he fell. I saw the blood all over him. I looked in just for a second and I saw somebody shooting and I heard everything. I ran back to the bathroom and called 911. They said for me to stay where I was, to hide and wait, and while I was talking, my phone died.
Me smiled a little.
You forgot to charge it again. I never will again, ever. The police came. A policewoman. I gave her your names and my mom's and Natalie's. They were in the mall. I forgot. There were three of them, me. That's what the news said. Two in the mall, one in the theater. Your mom and Natalie? No, Simone, no. They're okay. Mom got a concussion and some cuts from flying glass. Nat dragged her behind a counter. She's okay. They're okay.
She hesitated a moment, then pushed on.
Three of them. Killing people. Killing Tish. And we knew them. We knew them?
Me repeated slowly.
They're dead. I'm glad they're dead. J.J. Hobart. Oh, my God. Kent Whitehall and Devin Paulson were in the mall. J.J. was in the theater. He killed Tish. I saw them in school almost every day. They killed Tish. And Trent. He's dead. Tiffany's hurt bad. I saw her mom last night. Tiffany's. J.J. shot her. She might have brain damage and her face. I only heard a little. I don't know how bad she is. I knew J.J. especially was mean. Stupid mean sometimes, but...
Me's bruised eyes spilled over with tears again.
I'm the one who picked that movie. I wanted to see that movie especially, and now Tish is dead. It's not your fault. It's not my fault I went to the bathroom and wasn't there, but it feels like it. It really feels like it. But it's their fault, me. I hate them. I'll hate them forever. I'm so tired,
me murmured as her eyes closed.
Don't go.
I'll be right outside,
Simone said after the nurse came to the door and signaled her time was up.
I won't go.
Once or twice in the past, Reed had had very interesting dreams about getting Angie naked. Now, after recurring nightmares of hiding beside her dead body, he sat in the back row of the Methodist church for her funeral. He'd nearly talked himself out of coming. They hadn't really been friends. He hadn't really known her. Like, he hadn't known her parents were divorced, or that she'd played the flute, or had a brother in the Marine Corps. Maybe he'd have learned those things if they'd gone to the movies or grabbed a pizza or taken a walk on the beach. But they hadn't. Now he felt lost and guilty and stupid, sitting there while people who had known her, loved her, cried. But he'd had to come. He'd probably been the last person, who was not a customer, to have an actual conversation with her. He'd spent those terrifying minutes hiding a little boy in her kiosk with her body right there. He'd had her blood on his shoes, his pants. So he sat through the prayers, the weeping, the heartbreaking eulogies in a suit too tight in the shoulders. His mother had told him when he'd come home for the summer to get a new suit, and he'd ignored the idea as a waste of money. As usual, his mother was right. Thinking about his suit made him feel disrespectful. So he thought about the three faces he'd seen again and again on the news. Younger than he was, all of them, and one of them had killed Angie. Not Hobart, he remembered. He'd been in the theater, and the cop, Officer McVee, killed him. The reports said Hobart had worked in the theater. They said he'd been the ringleader. But either Whitehall or Paulson had killed Angie. They looked normal in the pictures on TV and in the papers, on the internet. But they hadn't been normal. The one he'd seen, still saw in nightmares, all geared up in Kevlar, laughing as he shot a man in the head, hadn't been normal. He knew more about them now, the three who'd killed a girl he'd liked during their 8-minute slaughter. Hobart had lived with his father after an ugly divorce. His younger sister lived with the mother. The father, an avid gun collector, taught his children to hunt, to shoot. Whitehall had lived with his mother, stepfather, half-brother, and stepsister. His father, currently unemployed, had a couple of arrests, drunk and disorderly, driving under the influence. Whitehall, the neighbor said, kept to himself and had some drug issues. Paulson appeared to be a model student. Good grades, no trouble, solid home life, only child. He'd been a Boy Scout and had a sports shooting merit badge. He'd been a junior member of the USA Shooting Organization with an eye toward the Olympics. His father had competed for the USA in Sydney in 2000 and Athens in 2004. People who knew Paulson said they'd noticed a change, hindsight, maybe 6 months ago when he'd seemed to become more closed in. That would be about the time the girl he liked decided she liked someone else better, and he'd hooked up with Hobart. About the time the three who'd become mass murderers began to feed each other's internal rage. They documented it, so the reports claimed, on computer files the authorities were still studying. Reed, in turn, studied the reports, dug into speculation on the internet, watched news broadcasts, talked endlessly with Chaz and others. As much as he wanted to know, just know why, he expected it would take forever for it all to come out. If then. As he saw it, from the pieces he put together from the reports, the gossip, the conversations, Hobart hated everybody. His mother, his teachers, his co-workers. He hated blacks and Jews and gays, but mostly just hated. And he liked to kill things. Whitehall hated his life, wanted to be somebody, and believed everything and everyone worked against him. He'd gotten a summer job, at the mall, and had been fired within 2 weeks. For showing up high, a former co-worker claimed, when he showed up at all. Paulson hated his luck. He'd concluded he'd done everything right all his life, but still lost his girl, and wasn't quite as good as his father at anything. He'd decided it was time to be bad. They'd targeted the mall for impact, and Hobart took the theater because he wanted to destroy the place that expected him to work for a living. Rumors claimed they'd done 3 dry runs, timing them, refining them. They'd planned to regroup at Abercrombie and Fitch, barricade themselves inside, taking hostages as bargaining chips, and taking out as many cops as possible. Whitehall and Paulson nearly made it, but they'd taken an oath. If one of them fell, they all fell. When Hobart didn't show, and with the cops closing in, Whitehall and Paulson, according to witnesses, bumped fists, shouted, "Fuck yeah," and turned their weapons on each other. Maybe some of it was true. Maybe even most. But Reed expected more and more would come out. They'd do a book. Probably a freaking TV movie. He wished to hell they wouldn't. He came back to the moment when people started to stand and felt a wave of shame that he'd been inside his own head instead of paying attention. He got to his feet, waiting while the pallbearers carried Angie out. He couldn't imagine her inside that box, didn't want to imagine her there. Her family filed out, grouped tight together as if holding each other up. He saw a couple people he knew now, Angie's friend Misty, some others who worked at the mall. It shouldn't have surprised him to see Rosie. He'd sat with her the day before at Justin the busboy's funeral. He knew Rosie had spent the last few days at funerals or in hospital rooms. He hung back, let her go on her way. Probably to another memorial, or to visit one of the injured, maybe to take food to someone who'd suffered a loss or was recovering at home. That was Rosie. The opposite of the three who'd killed. When he stepped out of the church, he walked into a perfect summer afternoon. The sun shined out of a blue, blue sky dotted with soft white clouds. Grass grew summer green. A squirrel darted up a tree. It didn't seem real. He saw reporters across the street shooting video or taking photographs.
He wanted to despise them for it, but wasn't he clinging to every word they reported, every photo they published? Still, he angled away from them, started for the car he'd parked nearly 2 blocks away.